This episode is just brimming with mirror images and echoes and parallels.
This week, we see all of these male interpretations of what Twin Peaks, the town, is. And why is that? Why is it shown as a male concern?
It reveals a lot about the complexity of Laura as a character.
The show doesn't pay off answering the mystery, but it is giving us a lot more rich thematic details.
Hello. You've tuned into Back to the Double R, where four fans are rewatching Twin Peaks from stem to stern. This week, we're looking at Season 1, Episode 4, titled Rest in Pain. I'm Colin, and this week I'm going to be looking at themes of doubling and darkness.
And I'm Damon, and I will be talking about Laura Palmer's funeral.
Hi, I'm Jennifer, and I'm going to be talking about all the different visions and interpretations of the town of Twin Peaks.
Hello, I'm Jonathan, and today I'm going to be touching on the themes of secrets and honesty, and we're going to take a deep dive into the character of Bobby Briggs. Each week, we want to, you know, lead off with a slight recap of the events of the episode that we just watched. Again, it is nominally titled Rest in Pain. It was written by Harley Payton, directed by Tina Rathborn. It was broadcast originally on April 26, 1990 on the ABC Broadcast Network. All right, so this week on Twin Peaks. The next morning, Cooper wakes up and has breakfast at the Great Northern Hotel. He meets Audrey, who confesses she wrote the note about Jack with one eye. Sheriff Truman and Lucy arrive. They're eager to know the answers to who killed Laura Palmer. Cooper does not remember all the details of his dream, but he does say, break the code, solve the crime. Albert has completed the autopsy of Laura's body, but his abrasive and insensitive nature provokes a fight with Doc Hayward. As the whole town prepares for Laura's funeral, the Palmers receive a visitor, Laura's cousin, Madeline Ferguson, who, except for long brown hair and glasses, is a doppelganger for Laura and is also played by Cheryl Lee. At the funeral, a fight breaks out between Bobby Briggs and James Hurley, and a grief-stricken Leland jumps onto Laura's casket and rides it down. That evening at the Double R, Sheriff Truman lets Cooper know about the Bookhouse Boys, a secret society in Twin Peaks dedicated to keeping the town safe. That evening at the Great Northern, Leland, his grief manifesting itself into madness, fails to find a dance partner. So one of the things that we've touched on in previous episodes is, you know, as the production of the television season went along, Frost and Lynch just couldn't like write and direct every single episode. They had to, you know, farm some of it out to folks. And so this is our second episode where it's a non-Lynch, non-Frost involvement. They hand the reins of directing to Tina Rathborn, who was sort of a Lynch protege. She directed a movie in 1988 called Zelly and Me, which starred Isabella Rossellini, who of course was in Blue Velvet and was, you know, David Lynch's paramour at the time. Lynch himself is also in this film, which I have not seen, but it's his first acting experience. And he sort of credits Tina Rathborn with getting him comfortable acting as a character in front of the camera. It's also probably not too much of a spoiler to say that David Lynch himself does become a character in Twin Peaks. So this is sort of an example of him sort of returning the favor, right? He's allowing Tina Rathborn to sort of take the reins and, you know, give this episode her spin. And I think, you know, she does a pretty good job of sort of holding to the Twin Peaks house style that Dwayne Dunham established. There's also like a lot of Lynchian touches. Like I'm thinking of the scene where they go to the, you know, the Hurley residence, and there's that focus on all the little tchotchkes and things like that they show, you know, that Nadine has. We're going to touch on this more in the funeral, but kind of there's a really great use of like slow motion and sound involved in that scene, which to me is, you know, 100% coming from Lynch. I also think it's pretty important to highlight the contributions of Harley Payton. He eventually becomes very, very important with the show. They sort of take the reins of show running it from Frost and Lynch as the show gets more deeper into season two. And I just think that some of the dialogue in this episode is really, really crackling. We get like, you know, the really famous line about this is where pies go when they die. And like a lot of the Albert dialogue just sizzles. Does anyone else have any stuff they want to say about either the direction or the writing or, you know, behind the scenes stuff before we get going?
Yeah, I noticed, you know, we go back to these long shots of wind blowing through tree branches and you know, stoplights swaying in the breeze as the light turns from red to green. So a lot of Lynchian touches from the pilot, even though he doesn't direct this episode, come back in a way that we kind of haven't seen for a couple episodes.
Yeah, there's a visual vocabulary for the show that has now been established. And that goes along with establishing sort of a conceptual or thematic vocabulary as well.
Yeah, I noticed there were a lot of these shots of characters sort of moving slowly, whether it's a slow dance or we have a scene of Bobby raising his hands in a slow manner. And to me, that's very much in keeping with the style of the prior episodes.
I'd like to spend the next few minutes talking about Laura Palmer's funeral. There are a lot of great scenes in this episode, but this has always been the one that's stood out to me. And I want to actually start with a fairly minor character, and that's Reverend Clarence Brocklehurst, who is played by Royce Applegate. And Applegate is one of these faces who you may not recognize his name, but you've definitely seen him in other things. He's one of these actors who just had a bit part in everything in the late 80s and early 90s. He was in Quantum Leap. He was in Star Trek The Next Generation. He was in, I think, one of the C-Lab or C-Quest or Stargate or one of those shows. He just was one of those guys who shows up in everything. He's a fairly minor character here, although he does reprise this role in a few episodes, which is a nice sort of piece of continuity for the show. But what I like about him here is this monologue, this eulogy that he gives about Laura Palmer and, you know, depicting her as this sort of strong, beautiful girl that was so important to the town. But what's interesting is that this eulogy is then interrupted by Bobby. And Bobby gives us a very different sort of vision of who Laura Palmer was, and touches on this idea that I brought up a couple episodes ago about how the whole town really knew that she was in trouble, that she wasn't just sort of like strong and unique. She was kind of wild and dangerous, right? And was living this dangerous lifestyle that people sort of knew about but didn't want to acknowledge. So I'm going to come back to that in just a minute, but there are a couple of other observations I want to make about this scene. The first is the appearance of Johnny Horn here. And we saw in a previous scene, Dr. Jacoby sort of slowly convincing him to take off the headdress that we talked about last episode. But he is instead clutching a book, and he's holding it almost like a Bible. And I never noticed this before my most recent rewatch of this. The book that he's clutching is a copy of Peter Pan. And it's interesting to me that he's clutching it like a Bible, because we talked about in the last episode how, you know, he's sort of a boy trapped in a man's body. But the fact that he's holding it in this way suggests to me, and this is something we'll explore in more detail in a future episode, that, you know, maybe his outlook on life, his approach to life, is a little bit more intentional than we might have otherwise thought, that maybe he's got a little bit more agency in this than meets the eye.
It's funny that we have Bobby and Johnny at the funeral, because Dana Ashbrook and the actor who plays Johnny Horn, Robert Bauer, they're actually best friends in real life, and they created a production company together. So it's just sheer luck of coincidence of the script that kind of like those two have sort of like the inciting instance at the funeral, and in real life, they're great friends.
That's a fun tidbit.
I love all this insider info you have, Jonathan. I was curious why Bobby pushes past Johnny. That seemed weird to me, but with your secret knowledge, Jonathan, all is revealed.
Of course, there's also the moment that Leland throws himself onto Laura's coffin. And in his utter despondency, he casts himself into her grave as if wishing to follow his daughter into death. There are two things that happen there that are compelling to me. One is Sarah has another sort of breakdown. But what's different about this one is that it seems like she's more concerned with sort of keeping up appearances than this tremendous suffering that Leland is experiencing, this apparent mental and emotional breakdown he's having. She says, "Don't ruin this," right? But she doesn't say, "Are you okay?" So that's kind of interesting to me. The other thing is that at the point that he throws himself on top of the grave, the coffin starts going up and down, and we hear a voice say, "Oh, the whole thing's gone haywire." And it to me is almost as if the grave is rejecting Laura's body, which is interesting because with her cousin Maddie walking around, and with all the flashbacks that we've had and the character development that we've had over the last few episodes, in some ways, Laura is more alive than she has been at any point in the show, at least in our minds. We know a lot more about her. And then the last thing I want to touch on before I open this up for discussion is the use of slow motion in this scene that Jonathan alluded to a few moments ago. What's interesting to me here is that when Bobby and James start to, you know, run towards each other to fight, they go into slow motion and Bobby's voice goes into slow motion saying, "You're a dead man, you're dead." But some of the other voices don't. We hear Sheriff Truman, I believe, saying, "That's enough, Bobby," but his voice is still at a regular pitch. It seems to sort of separate Bobby and his rage from the rest of the onlookers who are, you know, literally experiencing things in a different kind of time than he and James are. So with all of that said, I want to turn back here to Bobby's monologue. Because it reveals a lot, I think, about the complexity of Laura as a character. I think it's the first time that any of the locals have really recognized out loud the truth about Laura's dark side. Even Bobby himself previously said to Leo that he could not have foreseen what happened to Laura. Yet here he's saying everybody knew she was in trouble. So I'm wondering what you all think about this monologue. Is this just a rebellious outburst? A reflection of his anger, or is he the only one brave enough to say what everyone knows? Is he actually being insightful here, or is he just being kind of a jerk? What do you all think?
I mean, one thing I notice is that he implicates himself as well. So he's not just blaming everybody else for being unaware. He's including himself in that. So it, in a way, it's this, this guilt maybe and reckoning with it. It's interesting that we hear these competing things about the status of Laura and who she was.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like he's actually maybe coming to terms with this for the first time himself in a lot of ways.
I think with Bobby, this is a character who is very much still in like sort of a nascency. He's really trying to figure out like what kind of adult he wants to be, what kind of a, you know, like a man that he wants to be. So I think you get like some of it is, you know, not to kind of half ass on your question, Damon, but I think there is some truth to what he's saying. And I think it's also like an act of rebellion at the same time, you know, cause he's a young man. And, you know, I remember being, you know, 17 years old and you don't really have a great, you know, control of your emotions and you don't necessarily like, you know, think before you say things. I mean, I could still be guilty of that as an adult from time to time. But, you know, it's funny because you have like these characters that are in like these heightened states of emotion and heightened states of things that make it almost seem like they're, you know, in kind of like their own world, but yet there's real grounded emotions there. And I think this is very much a young man who, you know, doesn't really know who he is. And it's just kind of, he's putting himself out there, right? He's, you know, trying to do that in a lot of ways, like, you know, the most dramatic way possible. And sort of the same way how Audrey is like, you know, like interrupting your dad's business meetings or dancing at the Double R. Like, I think what Bobby is doing is sort of the same vein and like what Audrey is. It's like, you know, like a need for attention and wanting people to understand, but not necessarily knowing the best way to express it or an appropriate way to express
it. What's interesting is he planned it in a way. I mean, I don't know what exactly he planned, but back at his house, which oddly looks like a funeral home in that scene, I think a few of us thought he was at the funeral home, but he was actually in his home. And he's talking to his dad and he talks about how he's going to basically tear the funeral apart. I forget the exact words, but so you get this precursor idea that something's going to go down at the funeral where he's going to have some sort of outburst.
Yeah. And yet, you know, that sort of youthful absence of a filter, I think sometimes lets people say things, say the sort of uncomfortable truths that other people are not willing to recognize.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I don't want to step on some stuff that might be happening, especially in Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. And I have no idea, like, if like Lynch had some of this planned or like we're in this, but you know, there are things that happen in that technically have happened before this funeral that I think, you know, the character is reckoning with. So I don't know, you know, how much of the plot they had planned out, but I, you know, Bobby is in, you know, he's a character that's almost in constant transition. He's not necessarily, you know, fixed in the same way that we see, you know, some of the older characters like Pete or Doc Hayward, or even a guy like Albert, who, you know, very much knows exactly who he is and exactly what he wants and exactly how he's going to go about things. Bobby is amorphous. Nice we've been talking about Bobby because again I think, you know, Dana Ashbrook, who plays Bobby Briggs, I think he had a really standout episode this episode of Twin Peaks. And when I'm going through and, you know, rewatching each one of the episodes, I'm trying to think of like which character maybe, you know, was kind of the MVP of the episode or had really standout moments. That's kind of who I'm, you know, basing on who to sort of dive into here. And, you know, I didn't expect to be talking about Bobby this early, but, you know, nevertheless, here he is. I'd like to talk a bit about the character in general and stuff we've seen before, and just kind of, you know, what we think about him. One of the things that I think really strikes me about, you know, Dana Ashbrook here is that he's almost sort of like the evil twin version of Zach Morris from Saved by the Bell. I mean, not necessarily like, you know, like does evil things or bad things, but I mean, him and Mark Paul Gosselaar almost like look, you know, the same. They got the same kind of haircut. You know, Zach Morris is a blonde, he's a brunette, and I mean, that's going to come up later on in this episode. But I think, you know, Lynch wants to show us, you know, kind of your all-American, you know, high school quarterback, you know, young man here. And in some ways, Bobby is very much like that. Like you see him, you know, wear the Letterman jacket, and, you know, he clearly, I think, you know, cares about, you know, kind of being popular or a big man on campus. But yet you have like the character like flirts with darkness, right? He's, you know, he's selling cocaine with, you know, his friend Mike that he gets from Leo, and, you know, they get into all those sort of shenanigans. You know, what do we think about the character at this point? Do we like him? Do we think that he's, you know, a good guy, or do we find him annoying? Like, you know, what do you, some of you guys think about Bobby so far?
I see Bobby as one of these sort of stereotype or archetype characters that Lynch starts the project with. And he has this, he has both the structure of varsity football quarterback, but he's suffused with this darkness, this interest in chaos. He has kind of an appetite for chaos. And this episode is really interesting because, as Jennifer was pointing out, well, as everybody has pointed out, we're sort of seeing things from him that we have not seen so far in the show. And I think a lot of characters are starting to be revealed with traits beyond their primary archetypes in this episode. And I think that is part of what makes this so interesting. Bobby's kind of surprised me. He's so dark up until this episode, but in trying to turn the funeral upside down, I think he does realize something. I think this was a good point, Jennifer. He discovers something. He finds vulnerability in himself, which seems to surprise him as much as us. And then very quickly, he's back in the grips of darkness, threatening to kill James Hurley.
An interesting thing, we didn't talk about it, I think, last week. I believe it was in the prior episode where we see a scene of Bobby and Mike sort of cowering and looking more childlike and afraid when Leo was threatening them. And it was kind of like, you know, they were all kind of macho and boisterous up to that point. And maybe they are when they're encountering their peers like James. But in that scene, you start to see, oh, okay, maybe they're in over their head. And so I think that's where we start to see a few more layers of Bobby, maybe in the prior episode. And then today, he really blossoms.
He's a small town kid at the end of the day. And I think maybe he's gotten more than he bargained for and is starting to realize that.
One of the most hilarious things about Bobby is his reaction to his dad, the way that he just cannot even believe what his father is saying to him. And these two characters who are stuck together seem to me to be the far ends of this dichotomy we were talking about before, his dad being pure 50s, I mean, spouting propaganda right out of 1950s America, and Bobby being this sort of nihilist, you know, figure who is anticipating the 90s and this darkness. The other thing I would say about Bobby, I went a little different direction, Jonathan, from where I recognized him. And this is because I just watched a really terrifying documentary. Bobby looks a lot like the Night Stalker killer. He has that same weird, dark charisma that Richard Ramirez did. And I mean, it's creepy as anything. But I, you know, I having just seen these two things together, I think there's potentially a connection to be made. Certainly other pop culture references were there, and Dana Ashbrook is a great actor, but there's definitely some of that scary energy.
And what could be more Lynchian than Saved by the Bell crossed with a serial killer?
Right.
I want to touch on character alignment for Bobby before we move into a little bit of a discussion about secrets and honesty. But, you know, looking at our alignments here, I'm going to put him as a chaotic neutral, which, you know, according to the Wikipedia here that I got pulled up, says a chaotic neutral character is an individualist who follows their own heart and generally shirks rules and traditions. Although chaotic neutral characters promote the ideals of freedom, it is their own freedom that come first, and good and evil come second to their need to be free. And I mean, what does that sound more than like a teenager trying to like figure out who they are? And I mean, because he's not exactly a good guy. I mean, he's done things that are patently illegal and dangerous, but yet I do think that there is, you know, part of him that like, you know, can't help but be, you know, maybe good, or like, you know, it like brings out that sort of vulnerability that you were mentioning, Colin. Going into that, let's talk about, you know, I really want to focus on secrets and honesty. And while we're with Bobby and his dad, one of the great scenes in the episode to me was sort of the conversation that they're having between, you know, Dana Ashbrook and Don S. Davis, who plays his dad. And this is maybe perhaps my favorite parent-child relationship in the entire show. There's many, but I really love how like you have like, you know, Don S. Davis is his father who just wants to understand what his son is going through. And, you know, you have Bobby who just really doesn't want to like get into any of that stuff. He's almost scared of like how vulnerable he is. And one of the lines that, you know, Major Briggs has here that I find really great is where he says, "In ceremony begins understanding." You know, this is a man who I think, you know, is governed by rules, and, you know, he's going to be honest. He's going to say things how they are. And, you know, Bobby almost has like, you know, he's like many characters in the show filled with secrets, right? He doesn't necessarily want to give up, you know, any of that sort of stuff. And I also really love too how he like tells him like not to smoke, and it, you know, really kind of talks about like, yeah, you know, you were a varsity athlete at some point. Why are you doing these bad habits? So, you know, I think when you got this character that wants so much to, you know, hey, let's have honesty, let's have, you know, like a connection, and then this other character that almost seems to recoil from it, that's where you're going to get a lot of great, you know, tension. And you know, with these two men specifically, do you guys have any sort of further insight on, you know, Bobby and his dad, or, you know, stuff we want to add there? Because and you know, both those actors are just so great, and like their journey has a fantastic payoff, and it's, you know, starting here.
Well, first of all, I mean, you know, Major Briggs is correct about ceremony and understanding. As we've been talking about, it seems like at the funeral, Bobby himself has this sort of revelation that seems to connect right back to what his dad was saying. But I think what we're going to see is that there's a lot more to both of these characters than we're seeing here right now. I'm excited to keep talking about their relationship.
In terms of just like secrets and honesty, I also noticed that there's a lot of like physical actions of secrets. Like there's the secret passageway in the Great Northern where Audrey is like spying on her brother and Doc Jacoby. And like Shelley has that little moment where there's like the secret panel in her house where she hides the gun. Does anyone want to talk about, you know, just things that are like either like characters acting in secret or characters acting with like a lot of like emotional honesty that we want to touch on here?
That's a great point about I saw something in that too. The Audrey is looking through the picture into the room where Jacoby and Johnny are, and Shelley is hiding the gun in the shirt, and Catherine Martell is listening in on Josie and Truman. So there is this, you get the sense that everywhere in Twin Peaks, people are listening and doing things. The entire town is sort of suffused with secrets. The physical structure of the town is built on secrets and built for secrets.
And I think hidden objects in particular are actually loom really large in this story. You know, going back to the locket in the pilot being buried by James and Donna, and then
unearthed at the end,
and then unearthed only to disappear again. And there are going to be lots more examples of this as we move forward.
Yeah, I think some of what you're talking about, there's also the secret communication system. So I was also really intrigued by the listening in, and throughout Twin Peaks, we also see a lot of telephones. So maybe that's something that I want to pay attention to going forward, is how people are communicating overtly and also secretly.
You know, that's a great point. I remember we talked about the very first scene of the series where Josie Packard is putting on makeup at her mirror in the morning. And she has a look in her eye that she is savoring her secrets. And we see her later with Truman, the true man, who he just lives, you know, everything is on his sleeve. It seems like he could scarcely be duplicitous. And so the two of them together in this episode is a really interesting contrast. She's up to something.
I'm interested this week in talking about all the different visions that people have of the town of Twin Peaks. And in this episode, we get the perspective of insiders and outsiders about what is Twin Peaks. So as far as the outsiders, on one extreme, we have Albert, who is disparaging of Twin Peaks. He calls it a godforsaken burg, and it's a place that's not up to date. It's full of stupid people. And he has this amazing line where he has this litany of SAT synonyms for stupid people, where he talks about the morons, halfwits, dolts, dunces, dullards, and dumbbells. He just spews that out, as well as, you know, calling people yokels and hayseeds and chowderheads. All of the people in Twin Peaks to him are obstacles. They're all in the way of him getting clues about Laura Palmer's death. And so last week we talked about Agent Cooper being really respectful and kind of amused by Albert. This week, Cooper completely changes his tune and is stone-faced when he hears Albert talking in this disrespectful manner. And the thing is, Agent Cooper, as an outsider, is now becoming more and more of an ally of Twin Peaks. So Agent Cooper, we see him falling in love with Twin Peaks. He tells Albert life has meaning here. He talks him to his recorder, to Diane, a note about how he's interested in buying, potentially buying property there in Twin Peaks. He sticks up for Laura's body and showing respect for Laura's body, asking for it to be released so that her funeral can occur. And that's what's happening in the scene with Albert, where there's a big fight between Albert and the townsfolk over respect for Laura's body. And then within the Twin Peaks residence this week, we have these strong portrayals of Bobby, who we've been talking a lot about. So not only does Bobby show his feelings about the people, but he explicitly talks about his disillusionment with the town of Twin Peaks. And to me, it's sort of this Holden Caulfield kind of moment at Laura's funeral, where he derides everyone as hypocrites and he's tired of all the phonies acting like they cared when it's too late. And as I mentioned before, he also implicates himself, saying, "You killed her, we all did." So it's a bit of a disillusionment with the town, is what we're seeing from Bobby this week. And then finally, we have this secret society of protectors and vigilantes, the Bookhouse Boys, who we're introduced to. And they see themselves as protectors of Twin Peaks. And they recognize the town as special, but there's always been a darkness that they need to watch over and protect the town from. They're resigned to that, and it doesn't detract from their allegiance to the town. Truman says Twin Peaks is different, and it's the way we like it, adding that it contains a sort of evil as the price we pay for the good. It's almost like a deal they've made with the devil. And he adds that there's something very strange in these old woods, and we've always been here to fight it. So their vision of Twin Peaks as being this wonderful, magical place that has this necessary evil, which I'm sure we're going to hear more from when Colin, you know, talks later. It's just interesting to me that this week we see all of these male interpretations of what Twin Peaks the town is. And why is that? Why is it shown as a male concern? And I'm wondering what you all think about that. And if we hear from women in the same way about Twin Peaks the town.
Yeah, that's a great question. I can't think of an instance in the show where we hear a female character speaking in depth about what the town is like. And maybe I'm overlooking something, but I can't think of an example of that. And that is really interesting.
I have one minor one. I definitely think it's important that we see Lucy like there with like Sheriff Truman. And we haven't really talked about Lucy a whole lot yet. I mean, she's definitely a secondary character on the show in terms of, you know, hey, like Cooper's the lead and Laura is obviously the main story. But I do think it's important that she is there kind of not only as like sort of, you know, in a secretarial function, but she is bearing witness to, you know, like almost everything that goes on in the investigation. And, you know, she does, I think it's like nice that they show her like being diligent about her job. And in like many ways, she is almost sort of like an honorary bookhouse boy, even though it's clearly like an all dude, you know, institution. And again, not to spoil stuff going forward, but I definitely think there's parts where, you know, Lucy is going to sort of stick up for the town in a lot of ways, or, you know, sort of stick up for, you know, the Twin Peaks way of life, not necessarily in the same direct way that Truman does, but certainly I think in, you know, kind of her own surreptitious sort of behind the scenes way.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jonathan. She doesn't speak about the town, but she definitely keeps up on what's going on in town more than probably anybody else, right? Because every call that comes into the police station, she's the one who takes that call. And, you know, it's kind of funny, what this makes me think of is that when the show was on, there used to be a 900 number you could call. And Lucy, if you missed the last, it was basically for if you missed the last episode, but it was Lucy that you heard a recording of talking about like what had happened in town yesterday, right? So she's keeping up on the happenings in town, certainly, and chronicling them.
It's so funny because in the Twin Peaks Zeta A box set, they have these features where you can like basically watch like the promotional commercials that ABC did for Twin Peaks. And sure enough, Kenny Robertson And it's probably, I would say, the exact same stuff in that 900 number, right? She's like, oh, and this week, you know, like, you know, hey, we're going to catch up with Bobby and, you know, oh, what's Shelly doing with Leo? And it's I'm just like, oh man, this is like such great stuff that I don't really think they do a whole lot in like TV anymore when they like present it anyways, right? It's almost always like, you know, some, you know, like sneak preview voice man telling you about what's happening. No, but they really take advantage of, you know, Kimmy Robertson in that way.
One thing I might add is I'm along the lines of the women. One thing that I'm speculating is that the women, the female characters seem more, they're tending to relationships and the concerns and the intense things happening in their relationships. Like Josie is afraid of getting murdered, for example. And, you know, Shelley also is in a very precarious situation with her mm-hmm. husband. And we see Ed's wife, who is clinging to this idea that they might be headed to a better place in their relationship. We see a lovey-dovey moment with them this week. So to me, that's interesting, is that you see maybe the men kind of concerned with the town and protecting the town, where the women might just be kind of fighting for their lives and fighting for their relationships.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's maybe also why you see Sarah, like, you know, give that line, don't ruin this, you know, to Leland. Like, I think it's one, you know, maybe keeping up appearances, but I think, you know, that relationship is definitely at a point where, you know, like it could totally unravel, right? Like the grief that they're both sharing could just, you know, like make that whole marriage like implode. It's
very strained. Yeah.
Norma has a really great scene too, because I think, the parole officer for her husband like comes in and like, oh, I bet you're like really having to chase off all the dudes. And she kind of like, one, she like gives him that great look like, God, you're such a stupid man. I can't believe you talked to me about this crap, which of course is all said in her eyes and never verbalized. But then she has like that really great line where she's like, oh, I just tell them like my husband's a homicidal maniac that's about to be like paroled, you know? So like,
I know. Exactly. Well, I wanted to just sort of briefly talk about this parallel world that's happening in the soap opera Invitation to Love. If we can think about that as maybe a contrast to the town of Twin Peaks and the vision of the town that we're getting, we're also starting to get a vision of this parallel town in Invitation to Love. And in this week's episode, we see a little bit more of the soap opera Invitation to Love and are introduced to some characters, including sisters, I believe, who appear to be identical twins, who are Jade and Emerald. And we're introduced to them right before, on Twin Peaks, we're introduced to Madeline, the cousin, who looks exactly like Laura. And I was thinking a lot about this idea of the evil twin or the secret twin showing up is a trope in soap operas. And to me, when Madeline walked in, that was a mic drop moment in the episode where I was like, what? Like, what is going on? Is this Laura? Is this really Laura in disguise? You know, it's kind of a shocking moment. And, you know, we have yet to see what exactly it's going to symbolize. But I think that's maybe an important contrast to pay attention to, I think, as we go forward, if we see more and more of Invitation to Love and the soap opera world and how people in Twin Peaks react to that soap opera world.
Well, this crisscross of these two is really hilarious, the way the creators play with it. And so we are reminded that amongst all the other genres that Lynch et al. Are playing with is the soap opera. This is also a soap opera. And then when Truman and Josie are together, their faces are both sort of facing the same way. This is straight out of a movie from the 40s. And, you know, it lit just so. That also had that soap opera feel to it as well.
Yeah, the Invitation to Love stuff, I mean, it's, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that you're definitely going to see it again. And it's almost always some sort of a, you know, like either a commentary or a contrast to like what's actually going on in the show. And then, you know, I mean, we're getting like Inception levels of like show within a show, and then, hey, we're actually watching a show. So Lynch and Frost have a lot of fun with it. And it's funny because they shot all that Invitation to Love stuff in like one day. And like, obviously they meet it out over the, you know, the rest of the series. So it's clear they had like a big plan for like how they're going to reveal everything and when to drop all that stuff in there. Cause from a, you know, practical standpoint, there's just no way they can, you know, call in those actors. Oh, hey, we're bringing you in to shoot like 1 minute of footage. Nope. They did it all in one day.
So I want to talk about the concept of doubling in this episode. This is sort of a structural thing that you see in film and television where something, just like it sounds, something happens and then it's echoed in another way that advances the story, advances the characters, changes what the first image was. And this episode is just brimming with mirror images and echoes and parallels. Just a brief list includes Audrey, who goes to the funeral with her hair slicked back like Cooper, Truman and Lucy at breakfast, echoing Cooper is saying, Lucy says, damn, after Truman says, damn. There's a reference to Mike and Bob from The Dream, but then Cooper has to say, different Mike and different Bob. We see Albert and Doc Hayward fighting each other, both in their white coats. And interestingly, we see both Albert and Leland fall on top of Laura, each desecrating her body in a different way from a different perspective. There's something really interesting there, I think. As Jennifer pointed out, there's Emerald and Jade, there's Laura and Madeline. Of course, we go back to the double R. Bobby has his arms stretched out before a crucifix. There are all of these wonderful things. And that sound cue, I think, at the funeral, that really is a key moment, that sound cue when Bobby's voice pitches down and slows down. I think that there's something really interesting going on here in terms of this theme of the two worlds and the way that there is the light and the darkness. And in that moment where they're at the funeral, the entire cast is standing around a passageway to the underworld. And we heard Laura's voice, you know, we actually heard Laura's voice saying, help me, in that same low pitch. And so I might flip this around, Damon, and see what you thought about this. You said, and I think this is a good point, that the grave was sort of rejecting Laura's body. I might flip it around and say Leland in the land of the living and the darkness are pulling her, you know, they're fighting over her body. So she's being pulled down, but he's trying to keep her in the land of the living. And you know, it can be both of those things. But this surfaces theme that I've been exploring as I rewatch really hits a crescendo here in the conversation that Jennifer alluded to with Cooper, Big Ed, Hawk, and Truman, where we learn that more than just a theme, there is actually a light and a dark side to Twin Peaks. In several ways, we learn in this episode that Twin Peaks is disengaged from the world as we know it. Two or three times we hear Twin Peaks is a long way from the world. Albert says, I traveled back several centuries to get here. And again, we hear that Twin Peaks is not of this world. It is a different place. And of course, in context, it's all conversational and rhetorical. But at some point, you know, after the third or fourth mention of this in a single episode, you get the feeling, okay, the creators are making this point. Twin Peaks is a different kind of place. We see it again and again. And of course, Truman tells us there is a sort of evil out there, something very, very strange in these old woods. Call it what you want, a darkness, a presence. It takes many forms, but it's been out there as long as anyone can remember. And we've always been here to fight it, the light and the dark. There's another part of that monologue. He says, maybe that's the price we pay for all the good things in Twin Peaks. And that evokes this notion of, you know, the light and the darkness fighting and having to sacrifice. Laura is a sacrifice to the darkness, and Leland doesn't want to give her up, but the darkness will, you know, take her as a sacrifice. And of course, you know, this kind of tickles all sorts of deep storytelling stuff in us. And there are many more examples of these kinds of things. But I would say, here's my question for the crew. Am I overthinking all of this? You know, to what extent are we as an audience supposed to sort of play with this idea of Twin Peaks being, you know, literally magical?
I mean, I love this. In this conception, Twin Peaks is almost like a battleground between these two forces, right? And this makes me think of two things that I think sort of fit into the theme that you're arguing for here. One is, and I alluded to this last week, this idea that a lot of people have raised of Laura being sort mm-hmm, of an avatar mm-hmm. of the light, right? And she's, as you say, sacrificed to the darkness here. And the other thing that I'm reminded of from our conversation last week is we talked about the Red Room as sort of an in-between space, right? And what is the floor of the Red Room but peaks made out of white and black, darkness and light?
One of the things that, you know, to follow on like what you're saying, Colin, that sort of struck me when you were watching this episode is, you know, I try to put myself in the mind of like maybe someone who's seen this for the very first time, because episode 3 ends with Cooper wakes up and he's like, I know who killed Laura Palmer. And I think, you know, I think most audiences are going to want that question answered immediately. And of course, like Lynch and Frost and, you know, Tina Rathborn and Harley Pitton, they don't give us that. But they do, I think, follow up on sort of the, you know, the promise that the dream has. You know, when I watch the dream, I kind of think of it as like the sort of the crossing the Rubicon moment for the show. It's like, hey, you're either all in or here's a nice way to get back out afterwards. And like this episode, I think, follows up on that promise in a lot of really great ways. One, I think, is when, you know, Truman says finally out loud, what we've all been kind of noticing, that, hey, there's evil in those woods, right? Which is huge, because that's, I think, a lot of the driving narrative of the remaining of the show is that balance between good and evil. And I think they also do a really good job. They don't tell you who killed Laura Palmer, but like they have that great scene, you know, where Cooper mentions, oh, you know, sometimes my arms bend back, right? They're already like immediately paying off like some of these little like tidbits, you know, that you get here. So, you know, the show doesn't pay off like the answer to the mystery, but it is giving us a lot more rich thematic details in terms of like, you know, what ultimately the show is going to be like, more of a, you know, that, you know, that good versus evil, or, you know, where are we seeing like secrets get, you know, hidden and unearthed, or these, you know, conversations where, you know, folks are, you know, forced to be honest or forced to, you know, hide something away. It's kind of everything's getting unearthed here.
Cooper may not remember who killed Laura Palmer after his dream, but I think he feels what killed Laura Palmer.
Oh, that's interesting.
For sure.
That's well put. You're right, Jonathan, that there is so much cat and mouse that the creators do with ending the previous episode with Cooper saying, "I know who killed Laura Palmer." And then he keeps Lucy and Truman on the hook, just like the creators are keeping us on the hook. Cooper explains his dream in unbelievable detail, down to specific phrases. And then he says, "And she whispered the name of Laura Palmer's killer in my ear. Who was it?" He says, "I don't remember." That's the one thing that he can't remember, but he's so excited. He's sort of back to, you know, he's that bright, jaunty Cooper. And he gives the premise of the show to us, which is an invitation: crack the code, solve the case. I think I was wondering earlier, if this, you know, the show seems to be a puzzle box, but what kind of puzzle is it? And in this episode, they tell us, crack the code, solve the case. It's going to be that kind of game.
And, you know, I like earlier, Colin, you were talking about all the echoes that occur. And I just wanted to point out one of those echoes that I thought was interesting. So we know that the letter J is important. And we are introduced to a whole bunch of J's, echoes of J's this episode. So there's a plastic fragment in Laura's stomach that is the letter J that Albert reveals. And then we also meet a lot of characters with the name J this week. I probably can't remember all of them. In the Bookhouse Boys scene, there's at least one character with the letter J.
Joey.
We have Jacques, also
Paulson.
Joey.
John Renault.
We have Jade in the soap opera. So it's kind of amazing to think about the number of J's. So we have more. The puzzle gets even more complicated if you're trying to methodically check off all the J's like we were doing last week in the rocks and bottles scene. So a lot to chew on.
One other echo that I noticed, that I don't know if anybody noticed the sweater that Leo was wearing in this episode, but
it was really vivid.
There's a black and white,
yes,
jagged right. line that looks a lot like the floor room.
I'll say this, pay attention to clothes that characters are wearing in regards to that pattern. That's all I'm going to say.
This is a great way to look at the show, because it gives so much enjoyment if you are the kind of person who loves a puzzle. And I think this is part of its lasting allure, is it's a big mysterious puzzle. And, you know, even if you know the answer to the question, who killed Laura Palmer, it's still being a really rich experience to rewatch. And I think anybody could rewatch this for this great big 30 episode puzzle that Frost and Lynch and everybody else created.
10 times in, I'm still finding new puzzle pieces that I hadn't noticed before.
And I watched this episode 3 times this week and enjoyed it every time. So
me too.
It's kind of amazing, actually. I mean, it's such great art that you can watch it repeatedly and get so much out of it.
Well, and, you know, even in terms of like puzzle pieces, right? Because there's obviously we're getting like the show within the show here, but, you know, you have like the puzzle pieces of like how like Twin Peaks was made and how it like relates to Hollywood, right? And like when we see, you know, Madeline Ferguson, right? If you're a fan of the Alfred Hitchcock film Vertigo,
yes,
it's a clear, explicit homage to
100%
to that film, because the name, you know, Madeline Ferguson, that's, yep, Kim Novak's character is Madeline, James Stewart's
Scotty
character,
Ferguson,
his last name is Ferguson. You know, they put the names together to create that character. And of course, you know, in Vertigo, right, Kim Novak goes from, well, I guess she goes from a blonde to a brunette and then back to a blonde again in the movie. And sure enough, you know, Cheryl Lee, who never, you know, they never intended her to be this deep, right? It's one of those happy accidents. Lynch, you know, loved her from the little scene she shot for the video with like her and Donna dancing, and they just made the role bigger, right? So, you know, another happy accident that Lynch just pulls into the puzzle and goes with from there. All right, folks, this week for The Twist, we wanted to talk a little bit about maybe some of the humorous moments in this episode. And I think we all kind of wanted to start with the scene. It's after the funeral and Shelley is at the Double R and she's, you know, kind of gossiping really with these two older gentlemen. And she does like a really crude recreation of Leland, like riding the casket down to the ground. And she's like going, and I mean, first of all, I thought it was hilarious. So, so funny.
She's using a napkin dispenser, a metal napkin dispenser that you can actually push up and down.
Like, I know we all kind of were like, well, what does this mean for Shelley and things like that? I guess my take is, for one, like, people in small towns gossip all the time, man. And, you know, things like that become like urban legend or sort of, you know, part of the town mythology. So for me, like, nothing seemed out of character at all. But, you know, what do you guys think of some of that stuff, or, you know, sort of the use of maybe Black humor in the show?
I mean, one thing about that scene to me, earlier in the episode, you hear about the whole town being sad about Laura Palmer's death. But in the scene, you have these two older men just like cackling uproariously as she's recounting what happened at the funeral. So clearly they were not at the funeral. So to me, it's also a glimpse that, you know, the whole town did not necessarily care about Laura Palmer.
It struck me as kind of uncharacteristically cruel for that character, to tell you the truth. I mean, granted, we haven't spent a ton of time with Shelley at this point, but, you know, she seems nicer than that to me.
I don't know. I don't think it says that like Shelley is cruel so much as I think it's just like, I mean, for one, funerals are strange because I think sometimes people feel compulsed to like laugh or like act out or, you know, do something strange. Not all of us have the courage of, you know, Bobby Briggs to just say what is on his mind at like the most inappropriate time at a funeral, you know? So I think, you know, you get some of these weird emotions and, you know, like Shelley is there really because she's like in the cast, right? They don't really go into any of her like relationship with Laura at all, right? She's totally almost ancillary to it. So like, I think it is, you know, kind of funny, like, you know, these two old guys and she's like, oh, I got to tell you about this crazy thing I saw when they had like Laura Palmer's funeral. And I don't think it really says that she's, you know, like a mean person, but it is kind of mean-spirited. Maybe I also kind of like mean-spirited humor.
I think I see what you're saying, Jonathan. It's sort of like the gallows humor in a way and, and, you know, cutting that tension. You know, in an earlier episode, we're told that Shelley is friends with Laura, but we don't really know what that means. I guess we're still trying to figure out what that means, you know, because she was on the list of the J characters, you know, Shelley Johnson, friends with Laura. I mean,
I mean, I also thought it was funny when like they have like the fight in the morgue and like Albert ends up like on top of Laura. Again, I mean, like I know one, it's like foreshadowing for what we're going to see, like, you know, not 10 minutes later. But again, I also thought, it's like, it's so stupid, but it also, it's like, it's funny that they, you know, this fight just ends with like this silliness with Albert ending on top of like the, you know, the corpse. It's probably the last place in the world he ever wanted to be, right? Like,
it's all, you know, I was trying to think about humor in the episode, and most of the humor in the episode is either this dark comedy, dark humor, or it's cutting, you know, Albert has moments of humor that are very cutting about other people, where, you know, he talks about Truman makes some comment where he's understanding what is going on in a certain situation, and Albert says, oh, look, it thinks, you know, that's supposed to be sort of funny that he's mocking him.
It's funny, but like, and you're like, God, Albert, you're such a jerk. But at the same time, like, he's not wrong about a lot of things either, right? And like, that's what I think is kind of nice about the humor. And like, when Shelley's joking, like, you know, from an outsider's perspective, like, what a ridiculous scene that whole funeral is. Like, if you're just to observe it without having any context, like, oh, they're fighting and oh, the guy like jumps on the thing. Like, I mean, it's funny from, you know, when you're looking at it from a non-internal lens, I think. So it's nice that they, you know, bring some of the stuff in there. I think a lot of the moments with Nadine are like secretly hilarious too. And we haven't really talked about Wendy Roby much, but like every time, like, you know, she comes on, there's either like, some people find it annoying, but I'm kind of finding it endearing on this rewatch, is that like, oh, you know, like, God, she's just like every moment she nails, and it's so stupid. But at the same time, like, you're like, you know, you need that stuff in there when there's so much heaviness going on in the rest of the episodes.
I'll tell you what cracked me up related to her was there's a scene in this episode where they pan across all her little knickknacks that you were mentioning earlier. And one of them is a woman in a bonnet, and an eye patch has clearly been fastened onto it.
I saw that.
Oh, that's funny.
Well, that's our time here at Back to the Double R. We'll be back next week with the next episode of Twin Peaks. Until then, hope your pie is warm, your ice cream's cold, and your coffee is black as midnight.